Hello and welcome to the final TCR Daily podcast from the Transcontinental Race number 8. The finishers party is due to kick off in about an hour's time, and riders have been steadily accumulating around the finish line all afternoon. And we're having our very own party on the pod tonight. We've got everyone involved for this one, and we're going to be kind of just looking back together and reliving all our favourite moments from what has been another amazing race. So joining me tonight for one last time, we have Becky, Karen, Rob and Ross. So hi guys, welcome to the party.
Hello.
Hey everyone.
Hello. So like I said, we've been having more like loads of arrivals this afternoon. Well, throughout the whole day today, really. It's really getting into the meat of the kind of mid-pack where you have the highest volume of people coming through. And it's at times today, there's been like little flurries of riders coming through where it's almost like they're queuing up at the finish line to get their card stamped. And there's been a few interesting and notable riders come in throughout the day. I think probably the headliner for a lot of people is Miko Makipa, who arrived this afternoon and typically had kind of planned everything down to the last minute. So he arrived just nice and comfortably before the finishers party, but not too much stress. And also typically of him, he arrived from the opposite direction to what anyone was expecting. So he came, the finish line is basically right next to the beach. So everybody is coming.
He didn't come in from the ocean, did he?
Yeah, he did. He came in from the sea. He came in from the beach and everybody was waiting for him to turn up facing the way that everyone is turning up. And then he just arrived behind everyone.
Amazing.
But had he done the parkour?
Yeah.
He'd done the parkour. And then had just done a sneaky round the back.
Yep.
Yeah.
And like everybody else had just taken the roads and he was like, I'm going to not do that, and I'm going to go around the back. And he just pops through the little gates at the back of the stand.
Amazing. He said it was a routing error, so we'll have to take his word for that. But I think
it was very on brand.
I think he was trolling the TCR. But yeah, we've had our eye on him, haven't we, throughout the race, and we've been looking at his interesting routing choices, which has been quite a source of entertainment for us.
Yeah, I think he's come up in every podcast I've been on, and we've just repeat the question, where is Miko now? Because his dot was far away from everyone else's, and at one point it looked like he was heading straight to the finish and missing out the Romanian leg, but not true. He has finished.
And just yesterday we were speculating if he perhaps had the entire wrong destination for the finish line based on his route.
Yeah,
because he was coming in at quite a weird angle, wasn't he?
He was kind of heading due south from the ferry port when everyone else was heading southeast across to Burgas. So I actually haven't looked back to see what he ended up doing.
But yeah, it's amazing to see him finish his 8th TCR. And
the longest TCR.
And the longest one. And he reckons it's the hardest one he's done. And it's certainly the longest. And we heard a few different figures for the length of his ride, but it was somewhere between 4,700 and something K. So, you know, considering, I suppose, the expectation is a 4,000-kilometer race, you know, that's getting quite significantly higher than that. So there was one rider who arrived that both Ross and I met in Gerardsbergen outside a cafe, and I think you shared a beer with him, didn't you, Ross? Jesko von Verden. And what's his story?
Yeah, so this is his third attempt at the TCR after, I think, scratching the first time, finishing but outside of the cutoff. Second time around, and this is third time he finished just a few hours before the finisher party. So that third time lucky charm definitely helped Jesko there. And if anyone's been keeping up with him on Instagram, you'll have seen his quite poetic tales from every day as he's been going through the whole race, and it's been a joy to watch, and super chuffed for him for actually making it third time lucky.
Yeah, it really meant a lot to him, didn't it? You could really tell that.
Proud as punch.
Yeah, he was really proud, and it just makes you think, you know, it's because a lot of riders finish and they're just either so knackered or they're still so focused on the race that, you know, they've got practical things to attend to, like finding some clothes or finding something to eat or drink, and they don't necessarily engage kind of emotionally until maybe a few hours later when they've started to process it. But Jesko was really right in the middle of processing it in the moment, you know, as he finished. And yeah, I don't know if any of you guys have had that experience where you've really understood the full emotional kind of gravity of the situation when you finished, or whether it's taken you a bit of time to process it when you finish a race.
I think I found it takes a bit of time to process. I think you're kind of so focused on just doing the finishing and being okay, that for me it's definitely taken a while. Have some food, maybe a beer, and then once you're kind of a bit more relaxed and you see other people coming through and you're seeing the effort that other people have gone through to get there, you can see the pain on their face that was probably on your face a couple of hours ago. I think for me that's when it tends to kind of really sink in what you've just done. You can reflect on it and be proud with it rather than just kind of battling through it still.
Yeah.
I found it's coming home and talking to other people about it that kind of makes it hit home a bit, and other people think it's amazing, and you instinctively go, oh no, but somebody else finished it quicker and other people did this that's more impressive and someone else is younger or faster. But it does take a bit of time to realize that actually what you've done is pretty cool.
What's been your experience, Rob?
Well, I guess I feel like I never really fully process it, which is probably why I keep wanting to do them again and again, because you do have this experience that is so far from your daily life, from the norm. And then while you're doing it, it seems like the most epic, long, never-ending, proper trials, testing experience. And then when it's done, it's gone and it's over. And it's funny actually, because going through this podcast while we've been talking about different events, memories have come back that I completely forgotten about. I was like, oh yeah, that's in there, that happened. So in one sense, I don't feel like the experience ever really gets truly processed and just keeps dripping back, or almost like you lose it to some extent, which makes you want to hit the road again to just try and capture that feeling. Unless, of course, you have a really, really terrible time. I never want to feel that again. But, yeah.
Rob, you sound like a junkie.
Thank you, Becky. You mean an adrenaline junkie, of sorts. Yeah, an adventure junkie.
Cycling is your drug.
Brilliant. Yeah. I agree to that.
And then we had our fifth woman arrive today as well, Kirsten Cluley. And you were there for her arrival. It was quite dramatic.
Wasn't it?
A lot of people arrived at the same time.
Yeah, she was showered with beer as she came in through the finish. There was a procession of them who came in behind her as well, which I thought was quite nice. I'm not sure if that was arranged. I thought it was nice how she kind of led this group of about four or five. And everyone went wild when they arrived. And the poor Gates family, who arrived at 2 a.m, they turned around to David and said, oh, we arrived at 2 a.m. No one was here. Nothing happened. And then someone arrives at this time in the afternoon and gets showered with beer. We really wanted that. So, yeah, I can imagine that must have been amazing for her. She looked like she was on cloud 9.
Yeah.
Just all of her friends were there. There was a great Scottish contingent at the finish line today, which was nice to see my compatriots there. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually, because there are different races that have a different approach to finish lines. And I think across the board with ultra distance races, they're generally quite low key affairs. When you think about something like Tour Divide, I think we were saying this before, there's literally just a barrier at the border and there's no one there. And that's the most extreme, I guess. TCR is like a control point that is going to be manned all the time, but there might only be one or two people there when you finish, like the poor Gates family turning up at 2 a.m., probably just a couple of people there. But I don't know if you guys have experienced either a very elaborate and impressive finish line or one where there's literally nothing there.
I didn't race the Pan Celtic this year, but I did go to the finish line, and it's outside the organizer's house in Llandudno.
Oh, yeah.
So he and his family are there. And then also this year, because the majority of the race was in Ireland, they crossed over from Dublin to Holyhead and then rode from Holyhead to Llandudno, which I think was about 50 miles, but there are only two ferries a day that the riders were allowed to take. So you had these waves of riders coming in. So within about maybe a 2 hour period, you'd get loads of riders come in and then they'd all be there to see the next riders behind them come in. So there was this really big atmosphere, but it is just this residential street in a town in North Wales. And then I've also seen the opposite, which for me was the Highland Trail, and I just roll up to a mate and Alan Goldsmith, and he handed me a beer at 6 a.m. You're like, yeah, thanks. I won't be touching this for 12 hours.
I think I've been lucky. I've often arrived at kind of peak beer hour, which means the beer put in my hand was very welcome, and also has meant that there tended to have been some people around. In some ways, I think it might be quite nice, though, to arrive on your own and just kind of, I guess, have a bit of quiet time to reflect on what's just happened. But beer time's also great.
I quite like Silk Road Mountain Race, where, similar to TCR, you have a finisher's party, but because you are in the middle of nowhere, there's a lot more effort put in to providing food, and there's lots of vodka because everyone drinks vodka out there. So we're just all getting really drunk with Nelson Tree's dad, like, likes to drink vodka. So, you know, we drank a lot of vodka and had a lot of fun. Yeah, I don't really remember a hangover either. So, you know, they must make Kyrgyz vodka a little bit better, cleaner. Yeah, maybe not.
So I don't know if anyone's got their eye on the tracker at the moment to see who is likely to arrive just in time for the party. So the party kicks off in about half an hour. It's 7 o'clock over here.
How long does the party last?
The party's going to go on all night, but in a couple of different locations. So I think it's a couple of hours at the actual finish line, and then it's going to move down onto the beach where there's a little beach bar, and that will be until maybe midnight,
because it's important, isn't it, for one rider in particular? Yeah.
Yes, go on.
Well, no, fill us in, Tom.
Well, are you talking about the black jersey?
Yes.
So this is a TCR tradition where the last rider to arrive before midnight on the night of the party is awarded the black jersey. And so that is going to be in 5.5 hours time. And
so that's going to be 10 o'clock London time, Greenwich Mean Time.
Yeah, correct. So that's all right. 2, 4. So it's going to be probably one of these three. Oscar Short, Juris Grebbles.
And Sebastian.
And Sebastian Nolans. Maybe. So Sebastian Nolans looks like he might be taking a nap, and that could be strategic to
the absolute try and, firepower to the end.
Try well, or just to try and hold himself back a little bit to get to that.
Oh,
that
you think
midnight.
It's strategic?
Because this is a race, really, between these three. This might be a race to come in last out of those.
Oh wait,
three.
His. It says his tracker didn't update for 4 hours.
Oh, right.
Okay. So he might be out of contention for the black jersey then.
I can just imagine them all going to a petrol station going, no after you, no yeah. after you, no after you.
What's that race obviously... on the track where they all do track stands?
Oh, yeah. So they'll be doing that at the end of the parkour just before the finish line. Just looking at their watches.
Yeah, because how far are they? They've got about 125k-ish to go, 100k or so to go, those three, by the looks of it.
Ooh, 5.5 hours.
But yeah, then there's a huge gap after that. So
after that, really, I think everyone's out of contention. We have noticed there's quite a strong headwind coming in, I think, for that approach.
There is,
so
yeah.
That might slow them up a little bit. So it might even be...
Frank Proud might even
do it. So I think it's probably between those guys. So that's a very fun little point of interest for the final night, and a cool TCR tradition as well. And then our other bit of intrigue that's been rumbling on for the last couple of pods is this, what we're calling the GC Lantern Rouge. So this is the final riders to be coming through the final control point before it cuts off. And we were previewing a couple of riders that were approaching, which was Alexi and Pete, and we were trying to work out whether they would be in with a chance of getting it. And the really heartbreaking news coming through from CP4 today was that Alexi missed out by 7 minutes, we think.
It's going to sting.
Yeah.
That's tight.
And, you know, he would have been really pushing as hard as he could to try and get over the Transalpina and do that descent and get down in there, and that really is tight. And there was a bit of confusion around time zones, as there always is, because it gets a bit confusing. We initially thought he'd done it by 50 minutes and then realized he'd missed out by
I think Race Buddy works off of CEST, while the CP's cutoff was actually in EEST, so there were two different time zones to contend with there. But
have you guys had any experience of that, just missing out on a time cut?
I've never missed out, but I did come in 13 minutes before the close of the of the finish in Brest, and had some time zone confusion there, which was probably all my own doing after 4,000 kilometers. But either way, I knew it was going to be tight. And it's really stressful. You're constantly watching the clock and trying to push quite hard. And I knew it was so close. I knew for about 6 hours that one puncture could swing it. And I also didn't really know what was coming up, because I knew we were going into the final parkour, and judging by the other parkours that I'd been on the TCR, I had no idea what was coming. It could have been like a hellish gravel or a really sweet back road that took you away from a main road. Turns out it was fine and it all worked out in the end, but it was pretty stressful.
How long were you racing against yourself for, Becky? When did you realise, did you have a point where you made a decision, right, am I going to start chilling out or I've got to put my foot down? And
I think it was probably about 10 hours or so. And I didn't really think, I can either slow down and take it easy, or I can push to the finish. There was kind of only one option, that was to just at least try when you're that close. But yeah, it's pretty stressful, and it's horrible because it's also public as well.
Has anyone else got any stories about that?
Just the same as Becky, just very close to missing out again. I think it was a matter of minutes that I got in there. It's pretty tough. You don't know if you're going to make it, but you do. And I guess sometimes people don't. So, I mean, I don't know. I imagine it'd be super, super difficult for those who don't make it.
Alan Parkinson was the Lanterne Rouge at CP4, but just behind him is Thomas Weber, who is the Lanterne Rouge on the road.
So Alan Parkinson reached the CP4 last, but right now he has passed Thomas Weber because Thomas Weber seems to be having a navigational nightmare.
Oh, okay, I see.
Alan's now passed because Thomas arrived at CP4 like maybe five, can't remember how long before it was.
Okay,
might have even been a couple of hours actually, but he's made a proper mistake down there. So yeah, that's what the situation is.
Yeah, so Becky, you've been looking at this, haven't you? What Thomas's strange bit of routing around control point 4 on the parkour?
Yeah, so I initially wrote this bit, I think about an hour or so ago, and I said that Thomas Weber had 700 kilometers to do in about 29 hours, which is an average of 24k an hour, and that's cutting it fine. And that also includes the fourth parkour, so that would be a massive hit to any average speed, which they would then have to make up on the run in to the ferry. They're at the mercy of the ferry crossings, and then they have to get to the finish. So it's really uncertain whether he'd make it or not. But actually, I had a bit of a better look, and Thomas, having left the fourth control point, headed due east, which is along the tarmac road that's north of the fourth parkour. He then does a U-turn, heads south, back down the past the fourth control point, down the Transalpina, along the parkour, then does another U-turn back along the parkour and starts heading south on the route that the riders came in. And my first thought was, after one rerouting error where he initially left the fourth control point in the wrong direction, got on the parkour, potentially had just had enough, I thought it looks like he's going home.
Yeah, I would say that's probably the same. We saw something similar happen with Lizzie Jenkins, I think, when she got part of the way along the parkour and then had an absolute nightmare with punctures, I think, and then turned back. I'm not sure what she did, but I think yeah, maybe Thomas has had enough halfway along that parkour and has decided to head home. He might have also left the CP on the second occasion and went, you know what, it'd be really nice to camp up on Drumel Strategic, because he has stopped looks like asleep and then has maybe packed his bags and headed home. That seems like hopefully he's just heading home and he's not completely lost, but
well, good luck, Thomas, whatever you're up to. Hope it works out and you manage to get home if that's what you're doing. Or have a lovely tour if that's what you've decided to do. I can imagine going back over the Transalpina.
Like, there's better ways to get to Burgos.
Or another alternative is there's a couple of quite interesting little shepherd communities up there. He might have done a gatto and gone native and gone to live with the shepherds, maybe become a shepherd.
Meat.
Yeah, indeed. Becky, you had a bit of a shout out that you wanted to mention.
Oh yeah, James Houston. I haven't mentioned him on the pod, and I am unsure if you guys had already, but he is, as far as I know, the only Brompton rider in this edition. He's currently about 2,880k in. He's been out of the GC since the second control point, but he's still trucking on. And if anyone's missing Matt Faulkner's ice cream updates, James is doing some good stuff. He's also just like taking videos as he rides, so people get an idea of what the region looks like, especially riding through cities. It's quite cool. But his ice cream flavors are pretty wacky. There was a pina colada, and I'm sure we all know what that is. Then there's a Kiki Pugnosa. I had a quick Google, and it's some kind of assorted tutti frutti style lolly. And then there was a vanilla and Presley. And I tried to Google what Presley is, but all that came up was Elvis Presley. So I have no idea what Presley is.
Huh. All right.
So nice. If anyone knows, I mean, you can email us, but we're not doing another pod, so we're not planning for this.
An Elvis-themed ice cream.
Vanilla and Presley.
I can't think of one now. I'll try and edit in a funny Elvis pun for an ice cream. There.
Surely that's praline in a different language.
Yeah, it's probably praline.
But... Yeah. Yeah, true. I prefer Presley, though.
As I said, it's the finishers party tonight, and that marks the end of the TCR in many ways. Again, even though there'll be lots of riders still out there, it's a time when everybody's going to be looking back over what's happened over the past couple of weeks and just casting an eye back over all the action and intrigue that we've been really immersed in, all of us, over the last sort of 14 days. So I thought we'd just go back and have a bit of a reminisce really about everything that's happened, kind of talk about some of our highlights and some of the most interesting things that have happened out on the road and some of our favorite riders as well. So we'll kick it off talking about the winner of the TCR, Christoph Strasser. And I'm keen to get your guys' thoughts on kind of the first full professional really coming in and winning this race.
I think it's a really interesting point, and we mentioned before the pod how he is the first person who's come in as a professional, but a win at the Transcontinental has kind of bump started other riders' professional careers. Josh Shibbitt, James Hayden are the ones who come to mind. But coming in as a professional for me raised the question about riding in the spirit of equal opportunity. And there are fully amateur riders in this race who have full-time jobs and families and many of the things that can take up time in life. But a full-time athlete will have a lot more time to train. And in ultra endurance sports, that's arguably a massive advantage. And he did also come out and recce his Romanian route, which requires time and money that a lot of people wouldn't have in the same year that you're already doing TCR. So I don't know how you get around it. And there are many other ways that the sport isn't equal. But it touched on what I think is a really interesting moment in the sport, because we're at an inflection point of amateurs turning fully professional. And in a self-supported sport, where does sponsorship sit within the realms of support?
Rob looked like he had something to say.
not directly. I mean, I was processing everything Becky was saying, and it is a very, very interesting point. And I guess I was contorting my face because I was trying to think exactly where do I stand on it. And yes, it's a difficult one to police. And I guess for myself, I've never really worried about it too much because, I mean, I'm not at the point yet and it makes no difference to me when I'm racing one of these things. But maybe I know to a lot of people, especially like hardcore ultra cycling fans, that, for instance, when Lachlan Morton did the GB Giro and won it, and, you know, by quite a significant amount, but you know, Angus Young was chasing, who, again, you would class him as pro now, but I mean, it's a different level of pro, isn't it? So I see people like Christoph, you know, it's not World Tour pro. And I think, having World Tour pros involved makes it a bit different. The amount of time you get to train, everything like that. Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, it's difficult. I definitely don't envy race organizers. And yeah, maybe it is against the spirit of them. I mean, some people are very against it because they see it as, you know, it's a race for amateurs. It's like something that belongs to people who aren't professional. So then professionals maybe stay out. But then others love it because of it brings a spotlight onto it, and it, you know, brings more people to the fold of ultra cycling, opens it up more. I'd imagine there are people who dislike it for that very thing, because you do get a lot of people that when they do find a niche, they don't want more people to come in, and they want it to be their own little secret, as to say.
I was just going to say, it's maybe worth pointing out the different income model for a professional world tour rider and a professional bike packer.
Yeah.
A world tour rider, I believe, takes a salary from the team, and the team handles all the finances. But individual professional ultra racers or bike packers, their model of income is much more akin to a professional adventurers or expeditionists, where they will prospect sponsors and they build their own brand. James Hayden's probably the best example of this. And that is work, going out to sponsors, negotiating with sponsors, and then meeting the contract that's been written. It's not easy, and this is not free. So I think it suits those more perhaps entrepreneurial riders who can do that.
That was kind of going to be my point, that option is available to anyone. So if you are trying to compete against the Strassas of this world, then the opportunities are there nowadays, because sponsors see value in this and they're willing to sponsor people. You can do that, and you can go to sponsors and almost become a pro in that sense. It's funny you talking about the team thing, because it just reminded me that at CP2 I met a guy, and I wish I could remember the name of this team. I'll put it in the edit if I can remember. But he's effectively created an ultra cycling team. So he's kind of organized a few riders into a kind of organization where they can be supported, and they all have kind of they have like a media team as well as part of the team. So they all get the kind of coverage from a professional like media team, and they get supported in various different ways. So that, I thought that was really interesting, that some people are looking at it in that way. And maybe that's a way that the sport's evolving as well. So you might end up having teams that are sending riders to different events, depending on what their different disciplines and specialisms are.
It's a similar thing that we've seen recently in running. I mean, that is a world where it has typically been an amateur sport. I'm talking more in, like, from where I come from, in like trail running and fell or hill running. I mean, in the past, there was like pro races and amateur races, and that never turned out very well. They ended up crossing paths, and pros didn't want to race in pro races. They wanted to race in amateur races. And nowadays we're starting to see the same kind of divergence happen with, you know, amateurs and pros being put into the same races as one another. And it's now becoming easier to become a professional with, you know, access to social media. And I guess even, you know, the media that the races create themselves. I mean, we're almost like party to that. We have a platform, we boost their brand, we get them notoriety. And so it is becoming easier for people to create their own brand and be able to get an income that is different from a traditional model of being paid via a team. But perhaps it's you're sourcing your income via, you know, advertising, brand partnerships, race sort of appearances. So, yeah, it's a tricky one. I was actually wondering, turning away from the professional thing, Christoph, obviously he's had his first unsupported race at the TCR, and he's done very well out of it. For you guys, kind of what has been the most, you know, memorable moment of Strasser's you know, race, and what's your kind of impression of him as we sort of now go into the party?
For me, I think it was that moment when he leapfrogged, I guess it would have been Adam and Ulrich during the night. He kind of took a shorter sleep and then made his move, because I think he'd slowly seen him, you know, being kind of in 15th place or something for the first few days, and then, you know, slowly, oh, he looks like he's slowly moving up the rankings, and then he just went for it and was just, it was quite a dramatic, not that it came out of nowhere, but it was very distinctive, and you felt like he had just shifted up another gear, which he probably had. And it just looks like he played a very intelligent race, which I guess if you're a professional, you would hope that's what you do. But I suspect it's probably quite easy if you've got that Palmares, one Ram however many times, and you know, obviously a very well established successful rider already, I can imagine it's probably an easy mistake to come into something like the TCR and think that you've got it in the bag before you've even started. And I have the impression he genuinely did not think that at all, and he was taking it easy but probably also making a lot of mistakes in the early days. And I think he said himself, you know, he's a really fast learner. So for me, it was quite an impressive ride, despite the, you know, maybe having the advantages that we've just talked about by being a professional rider. He rode a really smart race.
Before the TCR kicked off this year, all eyes were on Fiona Kolbinger coming back as the previous winner. And she managed to finish comfortably inside the top 10 after facing a lot of adversity on the race. What did everyone make of her ride this year?
I thought it was brilliant to just see quite how stoically she handled the robbery early in the race. And not only the robbery, but then her, I guess, her handling with the local authorities.
She got bogged down carried, for quite a while.
And just carried on racing. And from the outside, I might be wrong, but it didn't seem like she let it get to her too much. Whereas I think a lot of riders would have been rattled by that.
I think you can just get a real sense of Fiona's spirit. Just every photo of her, she's always beaming. She's like got a big smile on her face, even though she's doing such a hard race and right up in the top 10. But like, you never see a photo of her going, oh my God. It's always like, hey, you know, it's brilliant. I love it. She's an inspirational rider.
Yeah, just super impressive. And same with every soundbite of an interview you hear with her. She's so composed. She's so thoughtful about things. And yeah, very impressive ride.
Any standout memories of Fiona on this race?
There's a few, but I think the funniest one was when we met her at the ferry terminal at Turnu. And she started doing single leg pistol squats in the car park because she was completely baffled by the fact that she'd only ridden 5,000 kilometers before the TCR this year. She wasn't feeling in massively great shape, but she came into it. And every time I met her, she was like, my body feels good. I've got no knee pain. Sure, I have saddle sores, but they're not that bad. You know, everything feels good and I don't know how. And then she'd started doing these pistol squats and it was like, see, this isn't supposed to be able to happen when you're this deep into the TCR. and then when I met her at the finish line, she was like, that was the last time I felt good.
Amazing.
After one pistol squat too many, I think she was done.
That changed the whole race for her.
Yeah. But she still dropped Andrew Phillips, so yeah. There must have been something going right.
I feel like there's another Fiona highlight that we need to talk about. That's maybe the, I don't know what it was. Was it loo paper? The kind of, you know, the headgear and kind of arm flaps. Was it baby wipes? I assume it was to do with sunburn, but it was a very strong look.
Yeah. When we came, it was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. We were driving through Romania just looking for riders, and I think Christiana Stratonix had been through, and we were just waiting for Fiona, and then we saw this figure on the horizon with just like flappy bits all over it, and we're like, what is that? And we knew she'd had a crash on the parkour in CP4, and then she came by and we were like, what is she wearing? And she just waved at us as she went by. And she had like these white cotton ears and white sleeves on. And we were thinking, has she like bandaged herself up or something like that? But no, she like knitted baby wipes together to stop the heat rash that she was getting all over her wrists and her fingers and on her ears. So yeah, she knows how to look after herself and come up with an ingenious solution to a problem.
One of the stories of the race, I think everyone would agree, has been Amarai Kuna, who's the recipient of the Mike Hall bursary, finishing in the top 20. And she's similarly just been such a breath of fresh air and such an amazing character throughout. So yeah, I'd be interested to hear your guys' sort of impressions of her during the race.
Yeah, just she's super impressive. She always seemed to be very collected and have a plan and was executing it. Am I right in thinking this was her first? Is this her first ultra race? Second
ever. Yeah, she did something last June. I'm not entirely sure what it was.
But yeah, she just. I mean, she. It was what was it? It was a bit less than a day after Fiona that she arrived. So, a super fast finish as well. Maybe she was kind of already known about on the scene, and people knew that she was going to be up there in the top of the pack. But if not, then wow, she's going to be up there in future races, isn't she?
Yeah, I think definitely one to watch. We didn't have her really on our radar. We knew that she was one of the bursary recipients along with Hashim Hassan, and we spoke to them both at the start. And you know, Amarai just came across as this wonderful breath of fresh air, like you say, and just loads of fun. And every time we met her, she just gave the time to chat. I think she was a bit like bemused at the situation that she was in, and really humbled by it and pleased to be where she was. And she didn't let the race get on top of her. She just did her own thing. And I think she's ridden a really smart race. She's only 24 years old. And she only really started riding in 2019, which is just fantastic. Mm. You know, she started just like riding through the Black Forest. And, you know, she's an environmental student as well. So she did everything right. She hates cars, and she tried to refuse every bit of single plastic, you know, single use plastic she could on this ride. So she's just ridden a smart race and has shown wisdom well beyond her years.
What I'd like to do is to get just one highlight, one hot take highlight from each of you of overall of the TCR.
Yeah, I've got one. I'm going to mention a rival podcast, but it's not really a rival podcast. The cycling podcast has this thing they call the Peddler de Charme, which is like, you know, the most charming rider. And for me, actually, I'm going to say that Robin Gemperle, for me, was probably the most charming rider to watch. He lit the race up almost like a Mathieu van der Poel of ultra cycling, and was just loads of fun to watch. He was a bit cocky and sure of himself when we met him at CP1 and CP2, being like, I'm not going to crack. I feel good. And no, I want to stay in the top two. This is fun. And then when I met him at CP3, he was like super humble because he just like absolutely blown his doors in Croatia. And then still managed to pick his way back through the field, had a great race with Christian Jakobek over Transalpina. And he just seemed to have good fun. And I think we really need to watch Robin probably for one of the shorter races, like Three Peaks or Race Through France or, you know, 2VS maybe. And I think, you know, when he's not helping his brother out with a pop-up restaurant, which seems to be his side gig, or any of his architecture work, I think we'll see him really ripping it up at races.
Yeah.
I thought the moment involving Ulrich and Christoph was with, you know, the drink where they Christoph bought Ulrich a drink, which at the time was quite contentious. And, you know, there's talk of they could potentially have risked the race for this one moment. But I thought that moment was very, very special act of camaraderie, where it's like, even though they are in an intense battle at the head of the race against each other, they can still take this time to share a drink and be friends. And, you know, and I thought that was just like a beautiful moment. I thought that was really good. And I thought it really encapsulated what the spirit of ultra racing is, because it's about the community and it's all done in good spirits. And I'm really glad how it turned out, and is, you know, happy to see that how it was resolved in the end. Yeah, I mean, it's also particularly important because it's one of those moments that does open up the conversation on the rules of the race and how people judge and quantify how these riders hold themselves in esteem, and how the outside dot watchers hold them in esteem as well. So yeah, I thought it was quite a pivotal moment in the race, and definitely a very exciting one, but yeah, one with great sportsmanship. Loved it. It was good.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think when people look back at this race, that's going to be one of the main standout memories that's associated with it. And I think the way it's been handled, we've ended up with a lot of positives to come out of it, which is a real relief and a really good thing.
I just totally agreed with Rob, really. And it was interesting to see how much conversation there was around it on social media, and how much the community kind of self-polices in a way, which I thought was really promising. The community can kind of step in and do that on the whole for the better rather than the worst.
I think one highlight for me, certainly in terms of adding the dramatic tension to the race, even though it was at the sake of someone's probably rather broken spirit, was that race to the Danube ferry crossing, I guess on the penultimate day of racing, when we had Christoph Strasser already crossed, and then Adam and Ulrich going for different ferries, and obviously Ulrich getting to a ferry that wasn't in the end running. I think it's a really, in a way, it's a really sad turn of events. But on the other hand, it just added a whole new dimension to the race that I think no one had predicted. And I guess it kind of reinforces just how much this race is taking place kind of out in the real world, where, you know, it's not like a road race where the race organisers have the perfect control of the course. You know, it's what the country throws, what the roads throw at you, what the world throws at you is all part of the race, and kind of has to be dealt with by the riders, even if it in some ways falls unfairly on one person. It could have just as easily been another ferry port that wasn't running. But yeah, I think that was it was a very exciting part of the race as a dot watcher, but I'm sure it was a really frustrating and difficult part of the race for Ulrich.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly created a lot of debate and really got people thinking, hasn't it? And divided opinions got people talking.
But I'm a little bit worried if it hadn't been in there, they'd have nothing to talk about right now.
Yeah,
at the party.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah, speaking of the party, we need to get to it, don't we?
Yeah, we need to get our Sunday best on.
Get our glad rags on. We're going to be late. So with that, we're going to sign off for the final time. And I just want to say it's been such a pleasure getting to hang out with all you guys every day for the past 2 weeks. And the same goes for Chris Thomas, James Hayden and Josh Ibbett as well, who joined us on those pods as special guests along the way. So thanks so much for joining in, guys, and thanks to Lost Dart and all the sponsors for making this whole thing happen, and obviously all the incredible riders who make this such a unique and enthralling spectacle to follow each year. Thanks to everyone who listened. We hope you enjoyed the stories, and we'll see you again in Gerritsbergen next year. And yeah, thanks so much to you guys.
Yep.
Thanks Tom.
Thank you guys.
It's
been a total honor.
Thanks for having us.
It has, yeah, thank you.
See you in Gerritsbergen.
Bye.
Tomorrow. This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.